I'm not saying I do. Worry about your family. What do you think I'm doing here? Worry about your kids. Pavlicek started to balloon again, his voice bouncing off the bare walls. Billy stopped answering, refusing to engage. This fuck? Are you kidding me? Pavlicek crumpled the poster, then tossed it backhand into a corner. Piece of shit. Hoping he would storm himself out, Billy remained seated and watchfully silent, until Pavlicek suddenly made his move, coming toward him so fast that he didn't even have time to raise his hands. But instead of throwing a punch, the big man blew right past him, and without another word stormed out of the apartment, the flung-open door pockmarking the plaster of the tiny vestibule before slamming back into its frame on the rebound. Trying to calm himself, Billy gazed out the window at the clean geometry of the distant stadium grass for a moment, then, turning away, picked Sweet Pea's poster up off the floor and dialed the number that hung in multiples from the bottom. Donna Barkley was a short, thick, snub-faced woman to begin with, and her company-issued maroon blazer did her no favors, her fingers barely peeking out of the two long sleeves, the jacket's center back vent angling out over her high and wide butt like an awning. "Hey, how are you?" Billy said, rising from his white plastic chair in the cement pocket park, alongside the office building where she worked as a security guard. She took a seat, reached into her bag for a Newport, fired up, and then turned her head away to exhale, exposing the cursive Sweet Pea inked across her left carotid. "Arista," Billy said, reading the insignia on her jacket. "They take care of you over there? It's a job for pay." Still not looking at him. "I got two kids and a grandmother." "I hear you," he said, removing the crumpled missing poster from his jacket and flattening it against the tabletop. "You were only supposed to tear off the phone number on the bottom," she said, "not take the whole damn thing." Billy gave it a beat, vigorously scratching his up-tilted throat. "So let me just start by asking you a few questions, see where that takes us. Who are you with again?" "Like I said to you on the phone, I'm an independent investigator." She gave him a look. "You got an ID?" He handed over his driver's license. "Something with your business on it?" Digging into his wallet, he pulled out a card for Sousa Security, his brother-in-law's outfit, which listed him as the assistant head of investigations, even though he never did a thing or took a dime. "And this is for free?" "I said that." "Why is it free?" "Because," Billy looking her in the eye, "like I also mentioned to you on the phone, we're opening an office near Lincoln Hospital, and if I can find him for you, word'll get around, and hopefully he'll bring us clients." A pigeon landed on their table, Sweet Pea's fiancé glaring at the filthy thing, but making no move to shoo it away. "Has he ever been gone this long before?" Taking her cell phone out of her purse, she responded to one text, then another, Billy torn between repeating the question and just packing it in. "Outside of incarceration?" she finally said, still texting. "Now and then." "So what made you so concerned this time?" "Because," she said, stuffing her cell back into her purse. "We were talking on the phone, then some whack guy called his name, and all of a sudden Sweet Pea hangs up, and where is he?" "Okay, this guy," he said, opening a steno pad. "White guy." "This white guy who called his name, did he say anything else?" "He just said, 'Hey, Sweet Pea, come over here.'" "Then what?" "Then Sweet Pea said, 'The fuck you want?'" The guy said, "Seriously, Pea, no kidding, come over here." Billy looked up from his notes. "And you're sure the guy was white?" "My phone doesn't come with eyes, but I know white when I hear it, and that guy was white all day long." "Okay," Billy said. "Then what?"
"What?"
"What did you hear next?"
"Click."
"And roughly what time was this?"
"It was 3:15 exact. You know how I know? Because he kept yelling at me. 'It's 3:15, bitch. Where the fuck are you?'"
"Good." Billy back to writing.
"Good?
Do you have any idea where he was when he called you?"
"I know that exact, too. He was just leaving my building to come get me, yelling, 'I'm walking out right now. I'm walking out right now.' Walking out of 502 Concord Avenue.
502, writing, then, this white guy, any ideas? Not per se? What do you mean, not per se? She shrugged as if the question wasn't worth answering. Billy hesitated, then, chalking up her truculent vagueness to a general case of whitey hatin', moved on. Was he having any problems with anyone recently?
Well, he's a talent promoter, you know? Her voice softened for the first time. Trying to help the community. But these kids he takes under his wing, they expect miracles.
Any kids in particular?
I'm just saying.
Looking away.
In general.
All right. He put down his pen. I did a little research on your fiancé before I came here. It's a crucial part of a job like this, and I need to ask you. Billy back in her eyes. Is he still slinging? She stared at him as if he were too thick to live.
I don't want to talk out of my area of expertise.
Do you want me to find him or not? She continued to stare, Billy once again ready to call it a day. One last. I asked you before if you had any idea who this white guy was, and you said, not per se. I need for you to elaborate on that not per se.
Not per se meaning like, I don't know who he is, per se.
But you know what his type? Oh, yeah. From what, his tone of voice? Uh-huh. And what type would that be? Your type. My type. She fired up another Newport, took a drag, then exhaled in a slow, steady stream.
You know what Sweepy always used to say NYPD stands for?
She said, tossing Billy's bullshit business card on the table as she rose to her feet.
Not your people, dog.
Having read him like a comic book from the door on in. He was still sitting at the table when he got a call from home, the unexpected sound of his younger son's plaintive voice making him naughty.
Hey, buddy, what's up?
I didn't even do anything, and Mom started yelling at me like I did, Carlos said.
Billy exhaled with relief.
Well, she had an upsetting experience this morning, so don't take it personal and just extra behave today, all right? You and your brother both.
But I didn't do anything.
Carlos, just do me a favor, okay?
Okay. Another incoming call flashed Pavlicek's name across his screen, Billy ignoring it.
Everything else all right?
Yeah?
You sure?
Yeah.
What are you doing right now?
Talking to you.
All right, I'll be home for dinner, okay?
Okay.
And everything's okay?
Yeah.
Your brother's okay?
Yeah.
Grandpa?
Yeah.
All right, buddy, he said, as Pavlicek attempted to ring through again. I'll see you at home, okay?
You didn't ask about Mom.
I'll see her back home, too.
You want to talk to her?
I'll talk to her at home, Billy said, knowing all too well that when things were tense between them, the phone was not their friend. He started to call Pavlicek back, hesitated, and instead called Elvis Perez at Midtown South to see if there was any kind of progress on the Banyan homicide. Perez was out, so Billy settled for leaving a message. He sat there for a moment, thinking about Pavlicek's afternoon flip-out over the Sweet Pea poster, then looked over his interview notes, which yielded only two pieces of hard information. 502 Concord, 3:15 a.m. If he were so inclined, he could do a canvas for possible witnesses, but it probably wouldn't be too smart. A detective from outside the local precinct, on his own, knocking on doors in the middle of the night to ask about Sweet Pea Harris, especially if Sweet Pea turned out to be dead. Billy imagining the barrage of questions that would then come his way, none of which, at this point, he would be prepared to answer, especially after having come so close to stepping in it simply by entering Eric Cortez's name into the system. So it had to be someone else, not a cop. For a hot second, he thought about hiring Sousa Security, but then bagged the idea. There was something about his brother-in-law he didn't quite trust. It wasn't that he was a liar, exactly. More like an omitter, as if the answers he gave you had to hold up in court. So, hey, it's me.
Hey,
Stacy's voice high and on the shaky side. I have some work for you this week, if you're up for it.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. once again sounding sunny but strained, as if someone was standing behind her with a knife.
You okay?
Sure.
Billy hesitated, then, where do you want to meet?
Can you come to my place?
In all the years they had known each other, she had never invited him to her home.
Yeah, no problem. What's a good time?
Now.
He began to smell the stale waft of old cigarette smoke coming from Stacy's apartment midway in his wheezing climb to her floor. When he finally reached her landing, Billy took a moment to catch his breath, then followed his nose down the long hallway to 6B, where she greeted him in the open doorway with a smile so tense he thought her face would crack. With its dim corridors, greasy slit of a kitchen, and small living room filled with indifferent furniture and overflowing ashtrays, the apartment reeked of resignation, and it made Billy ache to think what life could have been like for her right now if she had only looked elsewhere to make her journalistic bones. Her boyfriend's plaid bathrobe matched the fabric of the couch so well that Billy didn't even realize the guy was in the room until he reached for his beer.
Hey, how are you? Billy couldn't remember his name.
Lying flat on his back, the boyfriend made no effort to sit up or even turn to face him.
Superb.
Stacy stood mutely between them, looking first at Billy, then her boyfriend, then back to Billy, her face still tense and expectant. It was the collection of amber prescription bottles on the coffee table that first caught his eye, then the edge of the butterfly bandage on the ridge above the boyfriend's averted brow. Then the face full on, as lumpy as a thumbed hunk of clay, his skin the color of overripe bananas, the sclera of one eye hemorrhaged to a neon red.
Did you call the cops? He asked Stacy.
Of course.
And?
They came.
And?
And nothing.
What happened? He asked the boyfriend.
Some gentleman must have come into the vestibule right behind me last night, and...
He shrugged. What did he look like, this gentleman?
He was behind me.
Did he say anything?
Nothing.
Race, hair, clothes?
Nothing.
Then,
it's my own fault.
Why do you say that? The boyfriend turned his face away again. Why do you say that? Billy's voice sharper now. Stacy touched Billy's arm. What time was this? Asking both of them.
About 1 in the morning.
The boyfriend answered.
And where were you coming from?
The jaunting car.
What's that?
The bar where he first met you, she said.
Were you there too?
I left about 1.5 hours before he did,
sounding embarrassed about it.
No, not embarrassed, he thought. More like defeated.
Did anybody in there talk to you? Either of you?
People in there tend to talk to themselves,
the boyfriend said. Anybody giving you a hard time?
Not really.
What's not really mean? Billy getting hot again.
A 75-year-old psoriatic called me an asshole.
Anybody else?
Call me an asshole?
I'm trying to help you here.
I appreciate it,
the boyfriend said carefully. All right, let me make a call, Billy said, this time by way of an apology. Gesturing to the open beer, he said, you have an extra one of those? As Stacy headed to the kitchen, Billy retreated to a corridor off the living room and worked to get a handle on his rage. He tried to picture it. This guy stays to drink after Stacy, and not for the first time, is unable to coax him out of the bar and so just gives up and leaves. He continues to drink alone for another 90 minutes, waiting for happy or bright or successful to kick in, before finally giving up and herky-jerking his way home. And at 1 in the morning, he couldn't have been more of a staked lamb out there. A street-dumb, self-hating smartass reeking of death wish. Probably not even caring, once he got his load on, whether he was heading home or straight off a cliff. Fuck the mugger. What detective worth his salt wouldn't want to strangle a guy like that himself? Victims like Stacy's boyfriend made you feel like a nameless bit player in some narcissistic melodrama performed before an audience of one. Made you feel demeaned. Billy paced the short corridor, hating on the victim while trying not to give a thought to the person who had battered his face into a bloody stew. It couldn't be him. Coming back into the living room, he ignored Stacy's offered beer and went right at the boyfriend.
The guy who beat you, what did he take?
My dignity, Billy threw him a look.
And my wallet, he quickly added.
Then not him, unless he took the wallet to throw Billy off.
but that would defeat the purpose, would obscure the message, and the message was the point, unless... All right, let me make a call, he repeated. Before leaving, Billy looked around the apartment one last time, then thinking once again how Stacy's life might have turned out if she'd been a little less reckless with him, he added, I'm sorry. For what? She asked brightly, but she knew. Heading to his car, Billy called home and got no answer, not even the answering machine. He called again and got the same, which made him break into a trot. What was he up to? Billy had been expecting him to keep moving in deeper on his family, but attacking Stacy's boyfriend, if he had attacked Stacy's boyfriend, seemed to be about going outward, maybe going so far outward that he and everyone else would be going crazy wondering if it was still him. And if that, in fact, who the fuck knew was his game plan, then who would be next? Millie Singh? His sister? Maybe one of Billy's friends or one of his friends' spouses or kids? Then after that, maybe going in deep again. And the next time he came after Carmen or the kids or his father. Billy flashing on the boyfriend's bashed-in face. The outcome would be a lot more catastrophic than a vandalized jacket or a free ride to Harlem. Was this guy a genius? Or had Stacy's boyfriend just straight-up gotten mugged? Either way, he had Billy by the balls. A third fruitless call home while driving north on the Henry Hudson had him pushing 85. Stacy called as he was flying past the Roosevelt Raceway. Hey, you walked out so fast you forgot to tell me about the job. Turns out it's not happening for a while, he said, wanting to keep her and hers out of the line of fire. Pulling onto his street in the early dark of the evening, Billy saw a figure sitting motionless on the front porch of his house. Knowing that no cop patrolling the grounds would just take a breather like that, he glided to a stop a few driveways down, got out of the car, and began to cautiously make the rest of his way on foot. But apparently his tread was heavier than he imagined. Sensing Billy's approach, the figure slowly rose and then eased into a shooter's stance. Pulling his own weapon, Billy carefully stepped back into the shadowed shrubbery, the numbing notion abruptly rising in him that it was too late, he was too late, and that everyone inside was gone. In sudden freefall, Billy mindlessly recited the roll call of his dead as he sighted his Glock, center mass, and was about to squeeze one off when Carmen opened the door behind the shooter's back. Dad, come inside, you're going to get sick out here. Then, what the hell are you doing? Give me that. There's someone out there, Billy Sr. said tentatively, allowing his daughter-in-law to bring him back into the house. 2 hours later, Jimmy Whelan, accompanied by a small, nervous, near-mute woman, most likely another of his vertical harem of tenants, entered the house without knocking. Jimmy! Carmen kissing him while shielding the shiner side of her face. I'm sorry, this is a total waste of your time. Don't worry about it, Whelan said. This is Mercedes. The woman eyed the dinner dishes as if all she wanted in life was to clear the table. What's the matter with you? Billy nodding to the grip of the Walther sticking straight up from behind Whelan's belt buckle. You never heard of a holster?
If you conceal it, then no one knows you're carrying and it defeats its own purpose. Hey, Chief Graves!
Whelan saluting as Billy Sr. came into the living room.
Remember me? You're that kid from Billy's street team.
I am that kid.
You make detective yet?
You bet.
Where are you posted?
Fort Surrender.
Winking to Billy.
I never liked that moniker. It's too cynical for my taste.
Well, sir, we live in cynical times.
What's a rook to think?
Senior said.
Congratulations, son. You've been assigned to Fort Surrender.
You've got a point there, boss.
Well, keep up the good work,
the old man said, turning to the TV. Billy nodded toward the porch and Whelan followed him out.
The gun was his?
Whelan asked after getting the update. It's his old service piece. I had it spiked the day he moved in. Whelan briefly stepped over to the window. Peering into the house, he tried to catch the eye of his sleepover date sitting on the couch next to Billy Sr. Not for nothing and thanks for coming, but did you really need to bring the girl?
She's never been out to the country.
You're being funny, right?
About what?
All we have for you is a bunk bed.
We'll make do, so what else is going on?
Billy thought about bringing up Sweet Pea, bringing up Pavlicek, then let it pass. All right, my brother. Billy wrapping him in a brief hug. Gotta go. Halfway to his car, he stopped and turned. Hey, let me ask you, Tomasi, are you sure he was hit by a bus? Am I sure? Pulling out his wallet, Whelan gestured for Billy to come back to the porch. The American Express card, he intoned, handing over a crime scene photo of his white, chest crushed and staring up at the stars from beneath the front wheels of a Pelham Bay-bound number 12 bus. Don't leave home without it.
Well, the other tape came in. Elvis Perez's voice in his ear, the Midtown South detective catching Billy on his cell as he was paying for his nightly speed bag at the Koreans. From the LIRR end? And? Billy saluting June on the way out. And it doesn't really help us. Why not? There's too much of a mob under the track information board. It's like watching worms in a bucket. We can't even ID Banyan until he separates out from the crowd, and by then he's already spurting. You can't track him in reverse and blow up the frames? Worms in a bucket. Back at the office, the headline was that Feely had reverted to being a no-show. Otherwise, it was a next-to-nothing tour. A push-in robbery in Sugar Hill. A cabbie in the meatpacking district getting beat on by two men after he had refused to take them to Brownsville. Neither required his personal attendance. So after sitting there in his office for a few hours listening to the wheel effortlessly repel three more requests for the squad, Billy put Mayo in charge and headed up to the Bronx. 502 Concord Avenue was an eroding brick single-family Victorian chopped up into multiple SROs, and at 3:15 in the morning there were no lights on in any of the six windows that overlooked the lifeless street. But 505, directly across the way, was a six-story walk-up, and Billy counted three lighted apartment windows on the second, third, and top floors, meaning three possible habitual night owls, three possible witnesses to the possible abduction of Sweet P. Harris. Billy woke up the tenants on the second floor, an ashy-skinned, middle-aged man, dumb with sleep, coming to the door in his boxers as a woman in the back of the apartment screamed like hell about having to get up for work in a few hours. On the third floor, the door was answered after 5 minutes of pounding by a moon-faced African in a wrinkled caftan, kufi, and busted slippers, this guy having no English to him. But the TV in his otherwise furnitureless living room was playing so loud that Billy couldn't imagine him hearing anything out on the street short of an explosion. The sixth floor was the charm, the tenant, Ramlier Castro, a young, heavily inked Latino, his eyes pink with dope, coming to the door in sweatpants and a hairnet. Billy flashed his ID and Castro gave him his back, retreating into the apartment but leaving the door open for Billy to follow him inside. May I? Castro held up a blunt. Billy shrugged, and a moment later the punky tang coming across the wobbly-legged kitchen table thrust him back into high school.
Yeah, Castro began. I was up that night, you said, and I was sitting right here. I like to write poetry here, and I heard like this pop, 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 which around here don't mean firecrackers, and I thought it was Timpson GCG throwing down with Batanza's crew again. But when I looked out the window, all I saw was this guy getting out of his car and walking to the back like he was going to open a trunk, you know? But he was coming up on it sideways, you know, careful, then pop, pop, pop again. The driver like jumping to the side, but I didn't see no one shooting at him. I just heard the shots. And then after those shots went off, the driver just shoots his own damn trunk like he was putting down a horse, emptied the whole clip or whatever.
Wait, this is after you first heard the pop, pop, pop?
Yeah. So the pop, pop, pop was someone else? Which pop, pop, pop?
The first, the one that made you go to the window.
Yeah.
Then the guy got out of his car and shot his trunk.
No, then the second pop, pop, pop. I didn't see no one shooting, but the driver like jumped to the side of the trunk when the shots went off, and then the third pop, pop, pop was the driver shooting back.
Into his trunk?
Yeah.
Like what, returning fire?
Returning fire, yeah.
So like somebody was shooting at him from inside the trunk?
Could be.
Offering the blunt across the oilcloth top table, Billy demurely passing.
Then he shot back.
So the driver came out of the car with a gun.
Didn't I say that?
It was already in his hand?
I guess so.
What did he look like?
Who, the driver?
Billy waited.
I couldn't say.
First thing that comes to your mind. Castro closed his eyes.
He had white hair.
An old guy?
No, he had white hair, you know, straight hair.
So a white guy?
Could have been.
Not Latino?
Could have been.
Black?
I don't think so, but could have been.
So you didn't get a look at his face?
Couldn't see it, because it's like a straight down view from up here. That's how I know about the hair.
Clothes?
Some kind of coat. I don't know. Shoes.
How about the gun?
From the sound of it, I'd say a single action 38. Because of the rhythm of the shots, you know, pop, pop, pop.
You know your firearms? Castro inhaled again, blew out enough smoke to announce a pope.
Not really.
Tell me about the car.
It had a trunk. That's all I remember.
So, Billy hesitated then. No chance it could have been an SUV?
Could have been.
You know, Billy leaned forward across the small table. I asked you maybe 10 questions. All I'm getting back from you is could have beens.
Hey, officer.
Castro leaning forward right back at him.
I'm looking down 6 stories, 3 in the morning, high as a fucking kite. I think I did pretty good here, wouldn't you say?
Milton Ramos.
Marilise, watch!
Sophia shouted, blow darting the torn wrapper hanging from her straw across the small table into her father's chest. Don't call her Marilise anymore, Milton said.
Why not?
Marilise caught his eye. Go slow. They had never gone out of the house as a threesome before, and this dinner at Applebee's was something of a test drive. The waitress arrived with their dinner orders, double-barrel whiskey sirloin for him, double-crunch shrimp for the lady, and a fiesta chopped chicken and spinach salad for Sophia, who immediately went into a jaw-quivering sulk. How would you like Marilise to come live with us? He said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah!
His daughter shouting up a storm again.
Easy, easy,
he winced, although the din level of the room approached that of a machine shop.
Can she sleep with me?
Milton looked at his fiancée, a half-smile threatening to break across his face. Scraping off the breading, Marilise put one of her deep-fried shrimps on Sophia's plate.
So this is it? I'm not working for you anymore?
She said. Of course not.
But we're not getting married until next month, you said.
So?
So I can work for you until then.
Are you serious? I want you to go home and pack your stuff. I'll come by tomorrow with a van and move you in.
I have a lease.
Don't worry about your lease.
So what do I do then?
What do you mean?
What do I do once I move in?
Nothing. You know, just be with me. Take care of Sophia and the house.
Sounds like my job, but without pay.
Milton blushed. If you want, I'll get you a housekeeper. How's that?
Don't be ridiculous.
All I'm trying to say is you'll never have to worry about money again.
I don't want anybody working for me, she said. That's crazy.
It's up to you. Marilise stopped eating, stared at her plate.
I got a better idea.
What's that?
Can I say?
Milton waited.
My mother.
Your mother.
If she comes to live with us, she can help me with Sophia and the baby, and she loves to clean.
Your mother.
All I have to do is go back and get her.
To Guatemala.
She's never been on a plane before.
Sophia quietly took a shrimp off Marilise's plate, dipped it in the ketchup atop her father's fries, neither of them reacting.
You don't want her to? Marilise said. It's your house.
Our house.
Well, you're the man of it, so whatever you say goes.
Sophia took another shrimp, a handful of fries. Excuse me for a minute, Milton said, then rose from the table, Marilise tracking him with anxious eyes as he made his way to the front door. A wife and 2 kids, okay? Milton mulling it over as he paced the empty parking lot. but the mother-in-law. Then, think of it like this. Drop the in-law part, and that leaves you with mother. Which, given that he had just lost his aunt Pauline, the closest thing he'd had to one, was not so bad. When he returned to the table, he found Marilise, apparently having lost her appetite, feeding the rest of her breaded dinner to Sophia piece by piece. "She's good with kids?" Milton asked. "She raised me, raised my sons too." "How about otherwise?"
"Not great."
"Pain in the ass?"
"Kind of."
Sophia had become way too quiet, Milton wondering if it was ever possible to truly talk over a kid's head. To repeat, new mother, new wife, new son, all in one swoop. Then studying his already child, working her way through the rest of his untouched fries. New grandmother, too. "All right," he said, lightly slapping the table. "Go get her." Marilise put a hand to her heart, huffed in relief.
"When should I go?"
"How about tomorrow? I'll cover the airfare."
"I swear to God,"
touching his hand,
"if you don't like her, she can go right back. It's not like she doesn't have family."
"Just go get her."
"I can save you money on the tickets," she said excitedly. "My cousin's a travel agent."
"Well, there you go." Wishing she'd gone and come back already. Marilise leaned across the table and kissed him on the mouth again, which this time made him tense up given that his daughter was right there.
"Oh, Milton,"
Marilise saying his name for the second time in his life.
"Oh, Milton,"
Sophia aped, her eyes as lightless as pebbles. Later that night, it took him most of a bottle of chartreuse to work up the resolve to quit drinking. He had never been anybody's idea of a light drinker, but since the day he first saw the adult Carmen in St. Anne's, he'd gone completely off the rails, each night worse than the last, waking up every morning on the couch wondering how the 1 a.m. sports recap had morphed into cartoons. Well, no excuse for that now. Milton pouring what remained of the bottle into the sink. Still drunk on the liquor that hadn't gone down the drain, he took to wandering the house in order to start reassigning rooms. His first wife's sewing nook, now a nursery for his son. The sometime fuckpad guest room, no need for that anymore, going to his mother-in-law, as well as the nearest of the three bathrooms, hers alone. What else? Divide the den and make a playroom. All the hallway closets going to all the ladies. Then, running out of steam, he finally headed off for his own bedroom, walking in and seeing it for the first time as the gray cell it had become. Chapter 11. A 5 a.m. after-hours bar shooting in Inwood kept Billy on the job until 10 in the morning, and when he finally made it home at 11, still pondering his interview with Ramlier Castro, he was startled to see Tauru Tex everywhere. To cover the block from intersection to intersection, they were mounting Argus cameras on telephone poles, as well as on the house itself, the buzz and whine of all this work chasing away any hope he had of immediate sleep. 30 minutes later, as he was standing at the kitchen counter flipping through the New York Post and sipping his morning Cape Codder, Pavlicek called. This time, Billy picked up.
"You're screening my calls?"
"What?" Billy, too tired to come up with any coherent excuse.
"Look, I was just trying to reach out to apologize for getting so crazed on you yesterday. It's just that I have so much shit raining down on my head right now, I might wind up moving in there with you."
"In where with me?" Looking out the kitchen window, Billy spotted Whelan and his sleepover date making out on the kid's trampoline.
"Are you serious?"
Pavlicek said quietly. "Christ," Billy recalling that barren echo chamber of an apartment with the stadium view.
"Speaking of which, I talked to my guys and I can have it ready for you day after tomorrow. All you need are towels and sheets."
"My guys, you're always talking about your guys," Billy stalled. "The only guys I have are my kids."
"Yeah, well, you have your squad, too."
Billy put the phone to his chest. "Just say it." "Hey, John, I'm sorry to put you through all that trouble, but I talked it over with Carmen, and we're going to make a homestand." Silence on the other end. Then,
"Are you sure?"
Yeah. Intel sent over a threat assessment team. Taru's out there right now putting up cameras. Yonkers PD is running directed patrols. It's like the Fortress of Solitude over here. It's nuts to pull up stakes. Another bloated pause.
Are you okay?
Yeah, Billy said. I mean, given the circumstances.
Because you don't sound like you.
Yeah? Who do I sound like? Then telling himself, don't strain for jokes.
You're not ticked because I lost it over Sweet Pea, are you?
Absolutely not.
Is that why you weren't taking my calls?
I don't know what you're talking about, Billy said. Whelan and his tenant, still in a kissing clinch, came into the kitchen through the rear door.
I mean, how hung up are you over that skell?
John, I'm not hung up on him. I was just curious, Billy said carefully. And now I'm not. Listen, I gotta go feed the kids. I'll call you later.
Just another Smirnoff morning,
Whelan announced, nodding to the bottle. It's either that or chloroform, Billy said. The tenant went silently to the refrigerator, took out the milk and poured some into a saucepan that was already sitting on a back burner.
Hung up on who? Whelan asked.
What? Billy stalling once again.
You said I'm not hung up on him.
Sweet Pea Harris, Billy said. He's gone AWOL and I think he bought the farm.
No shit,
Whelan pouring himself a coffee.
And John's giving you grief over that? What for?
Billy took another sip of his drink. Do me a favor and tell me something, he said. The other day when I asked you why you were so hung up on Pavlicek.
Me?
Whelan reared back. You never answered my question.
What question?
Why you were all over me about Pavlicek.
How was I all over you?
Billy stared at him. Jimmy, do you know something I don't?
Like what?
Jesus Christ, look out that window, Billy exploded, pointing to the tarus crawling all over the front yard.
And that window and that one, Billy spinning like a bottle. I'm getting shredded here. I'm juggling chainsaws. So if I ask you for a straight answer on something and you stop playing me like I'm some idiot?
Whelan held up a hand.
If I tell you this, you cannot tell anyone, you understand?
Is it his health? Whelan blinked at him.
What's wrong with his health?
Then just say. Whelan took a long pull off his coffee.
He's trying to buy my building from the owner, but it's kind of very delicate right now, very touch and go, and I just thought maybe he said something to you about it.
Billy stared at him.
That's it? What do you mean, that's it? Are you kidding me? He swings this deal, I go from super to building manager or twice the pay. And if that works out, he's going to throw me more buildings. I mean, you know me, I don't need much, but I would like a little more than I got.
One of the security cameras fell out of a tree, nearly braining a passing taru before smashing against a lawn chair.
Anyways, this thing with Sweet Pea going off the grid?
Whelan rinsed out his cup. You should tell Redmond when you see him today. Why am I seeing Redmond today?
The funeral.
What funeral?
For your kid.
Billy went white.
I would go, Whelan said, reaching for his jacket, but I have a guy coming for the boiler.
The tenant poured the heated milk into a glass and handed it to Billy.
Para dormir, she said,
laying her cheek on her palm and closing her eyes. Edna Worthy was the only mourner to show up for her granddaughter Martha's funeral service that afternoon, so the folding chairs that lined Redmond's living room chapel were populated by a handful of last-minute stand-ins. Redmond, his father, his wife Nola, holding their son Rafer, four of the old men who hung out every day in the windowless reception area of the parlor like it was their old man clubhouse, two dragooned cops from the 28th Precinct Community Affairs Unit, and Billy, who was paying for the whole thing.
But Jesus said, suffer the little children, and forbid them not to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven.
The 400-pound minister intoned from the pulpit before pausing to take a hit of asthma spray.
Suffer, you see, in the parlance of those times, did not mean to endure pain. It did not mean to put up with mistreatment. What it meant was to permit, to allow.
Pausing again, this time to reach for the diaper cloth draped over the shoulder of his three-piece box-plaid suit and swipe at his face.
You see, in those days, children were not allowed to address adults directly, not allowed to speak up without the permission of another adult. Seen but not heard, I know you know that saying, and not just from olden times. I'm sure many of you heard it growing up. When Daddy is talking to Uncle at the dinner table, when Mama is talking to Auntie, you sat there, ate your peas, and maybe raised your hand for permission. But Jesus was saying, I don't want no middleman between me and these kids. I don't stand on manners. I don't need no hand raising, no permission slips, no velvet rope door man. Just let them kids in. And today, Marissa has come into the club direct.
Martha, her grandmother muttered, but loud enough.
She has come into the club direct, has gone, in fact, straight to the VIP room, where he is waiting for her with two chilled magnums of Holy Ghost love.
Are you kidding me? Billy whispered. You said $100 for the celebrant, Redmond whispered back. That's what you get for $100.
So what's going on? Billy asked, as a prelude to bringing up Sweet Pea.
Later, Redmond said.
Blessed are the gentle, the celebrant crooned. They shall have the earth as their heritage. Blessed are those who mourn. They shall be comforted.
Her name is Martha,
the grandmother low blared again, staring at the floor. Nola passed her son to Redmond, got up, and took a seat next to the old woman, putting an arm around her shoulders and staring without expression at the casket. After a few minutes of fussing in his father's lap, Ray first started to cry, and Redmond, needing both hands to rise from his chair so he could leave the room, briefly passed him on to Billy. Trying to stabilize the boy, Billy inadvertently pressed the feeding tube protruding from the kid's stomach, then jerked his hand away as if he had touched a snake. Embarrassed by his reaction, he reflexively looked to Redmond, now waiting for them in the doorway, the grimly knowing look on his face, burning Billy to the core. So what's going on? Billy repeated, once they were settled in Redmond's cubicle.
There's some Bigfoot kid going around the neighborhood, Redmond said, dropping Rafer into his activity walker, then locking the wheels. Says he's working for a charity, selling boxes of candy bars to the store owners, $50 a box. The implication being that if they say no, they're going to get their ass beat or something thrown through the window. Half the damn neighborhood's got those things by the cash register.
For real?
Everybody say he's all soft-spoken about it, but it's like, make no mistake.
You want me to do something?
I want to do something, Redmond said.
Did he try it on you?
Hell no. People are too scared of this place. It's like Muscle and Undertaker. Who's going to take on that kind of karma?
Enough. Can I tell you something? Redmond waited. I think Sweet Pea Harris was murdered.
Did somebody tell you it was my birthday? Because it is.
Well, many happy returns.
Who did the honors?
I was hoping you could tell me.
Me?
He was your guy.
My guy, huh? Redmond said. How'd you come to know about this?
Billy hesitated, then thinking, in for a penny, he began running down his interviews with Donna Barkley and Ramlier Castro, all the while bracing for another Pavlicek-style outburst about keeping his priorities straight. So the window witness tells me that this guy gets out of his car, walks to the back, ducks some shots, and then empties a clip into the trunk, which to me sounds like maybe, probably, there was someone in there with a gun. Like maybe the driver forgot to pat him down before he stuffed his ass inside.
Did he give a description of the shooter?
Not really. Then, he said he had straight hair like a white guy, maybe a Latino.
He saw that from the sixth floor but nothing else?
Apparently.
Well then,
Redmond rubbed what was left of his receding corkscrew crop.
Include me out.
Done.
So I hear you're moving into one of Pavlicek's apartments,
Redmond said. Actually, we're not.
Just as well.
Me and him, he and I, we're not getting on right now, Billy said, testing the waters to gauge how far he could take this. There would be no coming back from seeing too much, that he knew for sure. From the chapel, they could hear Redmond's father up the podium singing, He's prepared a place for me, in a high and furry voice. How far?
He's seeing a hematologist. Did you know that? Billy said.
Who is? John?
Billy didn't answer.
Man, you're all full of news today.
I'm just telling you.
The hell he is,
Redmond said, sounding annoyed. How far?
I hired someone to find out.
Redmond's stare could have stopped the train.
I know, Billy said, but I was worried about him. I am worried about him. I don't understand why you couldn't just straight out ask him yourself.
I did, Billy said. He lied to me.
A dapperly dressed funeral cosmetics salesman, pulling a sample case on rollers, poked his head into the cubicle.
Let me ask you something,
Redmond said, gesturing for the salesman to step off for a minute.
And I'm not even talking about any shit in the past, but do you have anything going on in your life right now that you don't want anybody knowing about?
Billy didn't answer.
Exactly. So whatever the hell is going on with Pavlicek these days?
Redmond reached down to lift his crying son out of the walker.
If he wants to tell people, he'll tell people. Meanwhile, why don't you just respect the man's privacy and leave him be?
Too far.
Coming home at 2 p.m, Billy walked in on Carmen and her brother weeping up a storm on the living room couch.
What happened? Billy said.
Nothing,
Victor said, wiping his eyes.
It's all good.
He's freaking out about being a parent,
Carmen announced with unnerving happiness.
And he didn't know where else to come.
I feel like an ass,
Victor said.
You and Richard are going to be the best parents, she gushed.
I kill aspidistras,
Victor trying to laugh at himself.
Hey, you have that dog, right? Billy just wanting to keep this good thing going.
It's Richard's dog.
I was just telling him, Carmen said. No one was more freaked out about having children than me. The dreams I had before Deck was born?
Billy nodded, thinking. You still have them.
I swear, Victor, I'm going to help you every step of the way.
Carmen tearing up again.
Those babies are going to love you.
Thank you,
Victor whispered huskily, holding her close.
Think of it like this, Billy said to his brother-in-law out in the driveway. Cavemen had kids, so can you.
And the average life expectancy was what?
That's not the point. Billy, I'm playing with you, he said, waving to Carmen, who was watching them from the living room window. You know, Victor, your sister, she's a real high-wire act, but she's got heart by the mile.
I know. Billy lit a cigarette, inhaled, then twisted his mouth to divert the smoke.
So why is she always so tough on you?
She's ashamed.
Of you?
Of herself, don't ask me why. Because she left me to take care of our so-called father down south? I was 13, and now I'm 36, you know? Shrugging the whole thing off. But I do know this, whenever she acts like she's trying to push me away, she's in a lot more pain than I am.
Billy felt like crying.
I don't know, Victor said, taking his car keys out of his jacket. With the twins on the way, I find myself thinking about family all the time, and I just want her to feel good about being my big sister, even for a minute. Billy nodded, then leaned in close as if Carmen could hear him through the living room glass. Can I ask you something? How freaked out are you really about these new kids of yours?
Not too, Victor said, waving goodbye to his sister in the window.
Tamika Washington, a tall, slender, light-skinned woman looking to be in her 50s, was stretched out in her bathrobe on the carpetless floor of her railroad flat living room, a rawhide bootlace that had done the deed still around her neck. A rolled towel was propped under her head, as if to make her comfortable, and a washcloth was carefully draped like a veil over her face, as if to prevent her from staring at her killer. Both gestures, Billy knew, textbook signatures of remorse. With butter and mayo canvassing the neighbors and the crime scene unit stuck in traffic, Billy was alone with the body when he heard a knock at the door. On the off chance that the actor had slipped the barricade in order to come back and apologize to his victim, Billy drew his gun before opening up and was surprised to see Gene Feely, his elusive butterfly of love, standing there in what had to be the last Botany 500 three-piece suit in existence.
You have Tamika Washington in there?
Feely asked. Then sliding past Billy, I just want to see her. You know her? Ignoring the question, Feely stood motionless over the body for a moment, as if paying his respects, then dropped into a squat and delicately parted the lower half of her bathrobe. You looking for something, Jean? That right there, pointing to a fading tattoo of a bird high up on her thigh. You see that? That was his brand. Whose brand? Frank Baltimore, he said, closing her robe as carefully as he had opened it. He was kind of a player around here for a few years in the 80s. Used to stamp his bags with a blackbird, same for a girl or two like Tamika here. She was hooking for him? Never. Well, not for him. I mean, yeah, on her own later. But she was strictly his girl before that. He found it down at Newport News on one of his dope runs when she was 17. Beautiful kid. Brought her back up and threw her a crib in Lenox Terrace. She told me she thought she was living in a fairy tale. She told you? Before I was transferred to the Queen's Task Force after Eddie Burns got shot. I was in narcotics up here and I had occasion to bring her in a couple of times, see if there was any kind of conversation we could have about Frank. She didn't know shit, but she never gave me grief about getting picked up, had these country manners. Didn't know how to be friendly, just never really got the hang of this place, you know? And when Frank finally went upstate, she got tossed out on her ass, a down-home kid ashamed to go home. Ah, it was a bad time for her. First she got dope sick, which is when she started turning tricks, and then when Rock came on the scene, I would see her on the street, down to about 90 pounds. But even then, she always had that smile for me, always that well-brought-up southern girl thing going on, and when she'd get picked up by the cops, she had my number, and I tried to get her out of whatever jam she was in. But it was hopeless. Anyways, kneecaps popping, Feely rose to his feet, his eyes still saying goodbye. I heard she finally got herself clean a few years ago through some church program, so good for her. That blackbird tat? Billy just had to say it. It's kind of in a hard-to-know-about place, Jean. At first, Feely threw him a hard look, then shrugged. If I wasn't so afraid of catching the package in those days, me and her, we could have had a little something. We came pretty close once or twice, but, you know, what can I tell you, it wasn't to be. Any ideas about the actor? With the towel, the washcloth, I'm thinking it's someone close, a relative maybe. She has a nephew in the halfway house on 110th and Lenox, Doobie Carver, a real nutcase. If you'll allow me, I could take it from here. All yours, Billy said, happy to see him seize the initiative on any run, for any reason. Feely stepped to the door, hesitated for a beat, then turned back to the room. I have to tell you, gazing down at Tamika Washington so intently that Billy wasn't quite sure who he was addressing. I know it can be a real hard-on, and you don't have the juice to tell me to do shit, but you're a good boss. You respect your people. You don't have a political bone in your body, and you don't ever pass the buck, so... Finally meeting Billy's eye. After tonight, if you want me gone... I put in to call myself. How about you stay? Billy heard himself say. I would appreciate that, Feely said solemnly, offering his hand. Does this mean you're going to start showing up when you're supposed to? Feely threw him another look. Don't press your luck. Then bent down one last time to Tamika Washington. Take care, honey, he said. Milton Ramos. She was supposed to come over at 9 the next morning for the money to cover her airfare. But instead, Marilee showed up at 7:30, Milton opening his eyes to see her standing red-faced and trembling at the side of his bed. What's wrong?
I'm so stupid, she whispered, her voice clotted with tears. She doesn't have a passport. She doesn't have anything.
Who's she? More drunk than hungover, Milton sat up, stood up, and then had to sit back down as the chartreuse rebooted.
My mother, why am I so stupid?
Okay, all right, grinding the heels of his palms into eyes. What time is it? Marilee's dropped down alongside him, her shoulders as slumped as his own.
This was a bad idea.
Okay, so you'll go get her when she gets one.
No, I mean getting married.
Getting married is a bad idea? Since when?
Last night I dreamed the priest was blessing us and my mother just crushed.
Crushed?
Like a flower, when they speed up the movie and you see it bloom, then dry up, then crash down to nothing, to dust, because she wasn't there.
Wasn't where? His skull like a soft-boiled egg.
There when we got married. She died in her house because she wasn't with us.
He took a deep breath, and his back teeth tasted bile. Listen to me, taking her hand. You had a dream. It's a dream.
No.
Everybody has bad dreams. You should see some of mine.
Mine always come true, always. When I was a girl, I dreamed one of my brothers was in the hospital. And the next day, he broke his back. When I was married the first time, I dreamed my husband got cancer, and I buried him in a year.
Then whatever you do, don't ever dream about me, Milton joking to smother his growing panic. Leaning into him, Marilise broke down, her boiling tears searing his skin. Okay, how about this? We work on getting your mother a green card, a passport, or whatever. Meanwhile, you come live with me, have the baby, but we wait to get married until you can bring her over.
No.
Jesus Christ, Milton's starting to sweat. Why not?
We live like a man and a woman. Maybe the same thing happens to her.
I feel like a prisoner of your brain right now, you know that? Despite the sharpness of his tone, he meant it more as a plea than a rebuke, though she seemed not to have heard him at all.
We can't do it.
Then, looking up at him like Our Lady of Sorrows,
maybe I should just go back to work for you, live by myself.
You're killing me.
Maybe I should just go back to live with her.
In Guatemala? Are you crazy?
I don't know what to do.
Milton shot to his feet, then immediately sat back down. What about the baby?
It's still our baby.
I know that, he snapped, then casting about for the next anchor. What about Sophia? She put her head in his lap, her hand clutching his hip. Jesus Christ, what about me? She began to cry, her hot tears this time turning him on, which only increased his panic. Okay, he said, not raising her head. Let's think this through. Who do you know in Guatemala?
My family, she said. Then, what do you mean?
All right, your cousin, the travel agent, who does he know?
I don't know who he knows.
You know what I mean by knows?
I think so,
she said. Then,
yeah, I do.
How about you call him?
He doesn't open up until 10.
Then call him at 10. But it was only 8, and they sat in coiled silence on the bed until 9. Then, without any preliminary communication, they began to go at it. And whether it was the overlay of doom in the air or just the emotional rawness of the last 90 minutes, when he finally rolled off her, they were both crying like babies. At 10, she went down into the den to make the call, leaving him damp-skinned in his bed. He loved the idea of making a family with her, yet until now he had never thought he actually loved her. But something had changed this morning. Milton Ramos was officially in love with Marilise Irizarry. If he had a pocket knife, he would carve it into a tree. 45 minutes passed before he heard her coming back up to the bedroom door. 45 minutes during which he had been afraid to so much as blink. But when she appeared in the doorway, her relieved laughter came to his ears like a flock of butterflies.
He said he has a friend.
Dreams, Milton said. You're crazy, you know that?
Maybe,
she answered, her face near radioactive with joy. Her travel agent cousin on Fordham Road in the Bronx had told her that he would be able to swing a round-trip ticket for her, Newark to Guatemala City and back, and a one-way ticket for her mother, all for $1,500, which was a good deal compared to the prices posted online. But in exchange for the deep discount, he wanted to be paid in cash. Whatever. The Windsor came later in the day when Marilise called him at work to say that her cousin had made some calls to a law firm in Guatemala City with embassy connections and found out that the package price for getting her mother a passport and a U.S. work visa, both delivered within 48 hours of payment, would be $8,500 American dollars. Milton's first reaction was to balk altogether, his second to negotiate the fee. Unable to do that, and fearful of losing his crazy, superstitious amorcita forever over a few thousand bucks, he bit the bullet
went down to his union's pension loan unit, and withdrew the money. Whatever, whatever, whatever. At 7 in the evening, the line for the JFK Express bus, which began across the street from Grand Central Station, was nearly 2 blocks long, the waiting travelers looking antsy and drawn in the early twilight gloom. "It would have been easy for me to drive you," Milton said for the 6th time.
"I like the bus,"
Marilee said, leaning into him for warmth.
"The bus always gives me good luck."
15 minutes behind schedule, the sleek, oversized carrier appeared at the crest of 39th Street and Park, and then just sat there through 3 green lights, torturing the people waiting 2 blocks below on 41st. "Anyways," handing her a gift wrap package, "it's for your mother, from me and Sophia." Instead of stashing the present in her bag, which would have frustrated him, she opened it on the spot, flapping out the hemp-colored serape he had bought from a Guatemalan street vendor in the West Village.
"Milton, it's beautiful."
I didn't know her size, but it's basically a bath towel with a neck hole, so... Marilee put her hands to the sides of his face and kissed him in front of everybody. Milton, still a little awkward with her new full-frontal affection, but starting to get used to it just fine. The bus began to roll downhill to the waiting crowd, but so slowly that it caught a red light while still a block away, some people around them audibly groaning in frustration. When the doors sighed open a few moments later and the passengers began to get on, Marilee continued to linger with him until, worried about her missing the flight, he hustled her on to the bus himself. It wasn't until she was well on her way out to the airport and he was most of the way back to the Bronx that Milton realized what an idiot he'd been. Who the hell sends a gift of Guatemalan clothing to a person already living in Guatemala? Chapter 12. Having caught yet another pain-in-the-ass last-minute run, this one a non-fatal stabbing in an East Village halfway house, Billy finally walked through his front door at 10 the next morning to find John McCormick from Brooklyn Narcotics sitting across from Carmen in the living room, 2 untouched coffees between them. "I thought I saw a firebird up the street," Billy looking to his wife, who imperceptibly shook her head in warning, as if he needed any kind of high sign here. "My supervisor says I should have pushed you harder the other night," McCormick said. "Pushed me harder about what?" "He was talking about collecting your guns, but I told him that was probably an overreaction." "An overreaction to what?" McCormick slowly got to his feet. "I need to ask you again," going into Billy's eyes. "What's your interest in finding Eric Cortez?" The only one seated now, Carmen repeatedly ran her palms down the thighs of her jeans, her face quizzical and tense. "You know what?" Billy's all-night exhaustion helped keep him calm. "I told you the first time you asked me. What I also told you was that I have, no intention to mess with anybody's play. So, you want to collect my guns? I don't know what the fuck for, but bring in your people and go at it."
"Is he dead?"
McCormick asked.
"What?"
"You asked me the other night if Cortez was dead. Why?" "Carm, let me talk to him in private."
"I'm not going anywhere," she said.
"Why?" McCormick said again.
"Because animals like him tend not to have long lives, and I hoped he was. But if I thought asking you would put me in any kind of jackpot, I would have kept my mouth shut. I'm 20 years on the job. How stupid do you think I am?"
McCormick stood there scanning him for tells.
"So he is dead?"
Billy asked, an honest question.
"No."
"Then I don't get it.
Billy, what's going on?"
"Carmen, just..."
"Hey, look who's here!"
Billy Sr. nearly shouted as he walked into the room and slapped McCormick on the back.
"Jackie McCormick, I thought you were in Florida!"
Billy watched as McCormick went into his internal face file for a moment, then shook his father's hand.
"Billy Graves, how the hell are you?"
"Never been worse," the old man said, then wandered into the kitchen where Millie was making his breakfast.
"What was that about?" Billy asked.
"He's your father?"
McCormick seemed a little dazed.
"Yeah, how does he know you?"
"He doesn't. He was with my old man in the TPF for a few years back in the 60s. I wasn't even born yet.
I just recognize him from pictures my mother keeps around. Billy peered into the kitchen, his father sitting there now, eating dry cereal and watching a talk show on the miniature TV that sat next to the microwave. He's pretty much shot, Billy said.
Are you sure about that?
McCormick's still coming off slightly stunned. Because I have to tell you, I look nothing like my dad. Billy experienced an all-too-familiar surge of optimism, then shut it down, the rhythm of his father's inexorable deterioration always spiked with these cruel upticks of startling keenness that raised his hopes for a moment before dashing them with the next time-warp slippage into dementia. Billy suddenly desperate to get away from his father before the next inevitable reminder came about of what a fool he was, is, always will be around the old man until death took him away. Snapping back into the here and now, Billy first looked to his wife, then to McCormick, both staring at him as if they had been following his thoughts. "You want to collect my guns?" he said, ejecting the clip, then handing McCormick the grip end of his Glock. "I have a Ruger in a lockbox in the basement, and my father's old hand cannon in his room. My wife can take you. Have a blast." Billy walked into the kitchen to fix himself a double-double, praying that his father would just keep his mouth shut and not make him weep. He didn't return to the living room until he heard the front door close. When he did, the sight of his Glock sitting on the coffee table in front of Carmen pulled him up short. "Where'd he go?"
"Outside."
"What do you mean outside? He left?"
"He's waiting for you."
Billy looked out the window and saw the dope confiscated Firebird gurgling at the foot of the driveway, McCormick behind the wheel and the passenger door open.
"Are you going to tell me what's going on?"
she asked. "I have no idea," he said, walking out of the house. The state-run nursing home in Ozone Park smelled like cooking diapers. Eric Cortez was in the day room, velcroed into a wheelchair, his face a soft balloon over his withering torso, his eyes beneath a strapped-on hockey helmet, the popped silver of a gaffed fish.
"For the seizures," McCormick said, nodding to the helmet. "What happened?" "He was shot in the head about 3 months ago and left for dead. A kid, actually the kid's dog, found him in a trash bag behind a housing project up in Dutchess County. When I ran him, I didn't see anything about this. It's not our investigation, plus we weren't too eager to post it in case someone was interested in finishing the job. What kind of hitter's going to have access to the system?"
McCormick stared at him. "Are you serious?"
"The bullet was a 135 grain spear gold dot from a Smith & Wesson 38, standard police issue."
"So what? We don't have a monopoly on that. Plus, he was a snitch. What do you think, he was the only one we were running? And when he stopped showing up for our meets, none of the others knew shit. Then we got the call from Dutchess. So when you went online looking for him..."
"So you're looking at cops?"
Neither of them was looking at Cortez anymore.
"One of the people we interviewed said that he overheard our friend bragging on knowing about a protection for pay racket coming out of a Brooklyn precinct about 2 weeks before he caught a bullet. Maybe he wasn't just bragging."
"So you're looking at cops?" Billy having no memory of just saying this.
"We're vetting a few."
"Anybody looking good for it?"
McCormick didn't answer.
"But that's where you're looking." McCormick cocked his head.
"Why? You think we should be looking somewheres else?"
"Do I? No, I'm just curious." Then, "I wish I could call this a tragedy." Taking Billy by the elbow, McCormick led him to the lobby.
"It's most likely one of the crew he was ratting on, but if it wasn't, if there's something to this protection ring, I mean, that trumps anything else going and we want to cover our bases."
When they got back to Yonkers 30 minutes later, Billy's father was sitting on the porch reading the newspaper, his mouth hanging open in concentration. From the driver's seat, McCormick ducked his head to take in all the Taru cameras trained on the house in the street.
"Something tells me the worst thing I could have done today was take away your guns."
The girl sat on her narrow bed in the sour-smelling suite, grinding her knuckles into bone meal. A shoebox filled